Okay. We'll begin on Daf Yud Tesam and Aleph. We're really just concluding, nailing in this last sugya that we saw. To sum it up very briefly, Rabbi Shua ben Levi introduced the idea that Bezdin will excommunicate somebody who slights the honor of what we said in a general way, someone great. Right? We saw this can manifest towards a particular chacham, live chacham, a dead chacham, this body of sages in general, or, as we saw, the greatest of the great, Hashem. Right? We all saw all different instances in where the chachamim would excommunicate someone because of that. Yud Tesamud Aleph, about two-thirds down the wide lines, right before the two dots. So Rabbi Shua.
What does it take for Bezdin to be a saint?
To? He has to do tshuva. Like for example, in the case, if he puts down a live chacham, it would involve going and making it up to the chacham. If he put down a deceased chacham, or the body of the sages in general, chazal in general, it would be tshuva. Meaning he would have to demonstrate to Bezdin, who would have to determine based on their discretion that he is truly contrite and that he's regretting it. Then they'd reinstate him. Okay. So now, Rabbi Shua ben Levi had said that we find 24 such instances in the Mishnah. Rabbi Elazar went out to find those cases and was able to scratch together three. So, this is where we end off. So we're on Yud Tes Amud Aleph, a third, two-thirds down the wide lines. Right? The last word on the line is Hecha. It's two lines before the two dots. So if we back up a little bit. Ella b'chavdalad mekoymes Hecha. Everybody okay?
Yeah?
It will be more specific. 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14, 16 lines up from the bottom. 16 lines up from the bottom. The last word on the line is Hecha. Back up four words. Ela b'chavdalid mekaymech Hecha mishkach asla. So at the end of the day, where did Rabbi Shua ben Levi get his 24 instances? We only found three. So the Gemara answers, Rabbi Shua ben Levi midama milsa lemilsa. You're right. Rabbi Shua ben Levi was not saying that you actually find 24 instances in the Mishnah where they did excommunicate someone. He was drawing off the instances that we saw to establish a principle that Bezdin will excommunicate, that the halacha is that you excommunicate someone who slights someone great. And therefore he said there are 24 other such instances in the Shas where someone acted in this way and presumably was excommunicated. So in other words, what he's saying is, yes, we find three instances where it's explicit that the Chachamim excommunicated someone because of a certain type of behavior, and there are 21 other such instances, equaling 24, where someone expressed himself in such a way that warranted this excommunication, and therefore presumably was excommunicated. Alright? It's about two-thirds down the wide line, you got it? So Rabbi Shua ben Levi, he found 24 because he was also extrapolating. He was saying, in these three instances we find that they did excommunicate, presumably in those other 21 where someone expressed himself disrespectfully, they excommunicated him as well. Rabbi Elazar wasn't thinking along those lines. He was looking for instances where it's explicit that they excommunicated him. So he wasn't drawing comparisons, so he found three such instances. So the truth is, both are true. Three instances where it's explicit they excommunicated the fellow. And there are 21 other instances where someone behaved in the same way. The Mishnah does not articulate that they excommunicated him. Rabbi Shua ben Levi is extrapolating and saying, presumably they actually did excommunicate the person in question.
Presumably somebody tried to find
him. I'm sorry?
Presumably somebody tried to find him.
Apparently Rabbi Elazar did agree with that. You know, he did his zip through Shas and did find those instances. But it's actually interesting. The Rambam has a different take on this whole Gemara. Yerushalmi presents this Gemara a little differently. Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi in our Gemara said we find 24 instances of somebody excommunicating because of, being excommunicated because of the honor of a great someone great. Yerushalmi is a little different. Yerushalmi says there are 24 instances of excommunication. It's all. And he gives the examples of someone who slighted the honor of someone great, someone who was made light in the Pilas Adayim, and the case of Chonia Ma'agel. So the Rambam understands from Yerushalmi that Yerushalmi means something else. We're not saying that there are 24 instances of a person being excommunicated for making light of someone great. There are 24 crimes for which a person is excommunicated. And the Gemara lists three. Now you go search the rest of Shas for cases of excommunication and you'll find what the other 21 are. So the Rambam actually sat down and did that. And in the Rambam, he gives a list of 24 things for which someone would be excommunicated. And the first three are, I don't know, the first three, but among these are the examples we see in our Gemara. Someone who speaks derogatorily about, disparagingly, about a great chacham, someone who takes the Pilas Yadayim lightly, he lists that as a different thing. Someone who speaks brazenly towards Hashem, someone who feeds Klal Yisrael mak psachim, etc. But he has a whole list of 24 things.
Do we know if the Rambam is able to find those 24 things in the Bavli or in your Yerushalmi?
Presumably he did, because he found because the Mefarshim there make a point of showing where he got each of the 24 from.
In the Bavli.
Yeah, I think so. Okay, just bringing out the point again. What we got out of this halakha l'maaseh is just bringing out the point again how a very important part of Jewish consciousness is what you admire. Right? The point here is that we want to keep Talmid de Chachamim with a halo on their head, not to cause a confusion of priorities. By these halakhas are not meant to be implemented. Right? The point is not necessarily to actually excommunicate people. It's like the Chazon Ish said about the different things that the Torah imposes the death penalty upon, but yet, right, we know death penalty is very clearly existent in the Torah, but yet the Torah makes it so difficult for it to actually ever happen. That we know that it says that a Bezdin that kills once in 70 years is considered a murderous Bezdin. It's very complicated for it to ever happen. So Chazon Ish says the main point of many of these halachas, and this is what's going on here also, is Torah uses halacha not necessarily because that halacha needs to actually play out, but Torah is primarily a means of training us to think, training us to have the right mindset. When a boy sees that for killing you get killed, he doesn't think killing is cool. Killing is a taboo, right? The Torah establishes taboos. Point is Chazon Ish says the more important point of these halachas is for a fifth grader to learn that this thing warrants the death penalty than for the death penalty to actually be carried out. Because the main point is to train Jewish minds. The Jewish mind sees this is punishable by death. The Jewish mind relates to this in a severe way. That's the main point. And really, that's the main point here also. The main point here also is for us to understand how severe the covet of a Talmud Chacham is, and how we have to relate to Talmud Chachamim, or even more than that, what's the prime aspiration of the Jew is Torah learning. That's the prime thing that he admires. Like, I think that if it wasn't
the Chacham. What does that mean when you're on Nidui?
Nidui is, well, in a general translation it's called excommunication. Practically what it means is that they impose a certain curse on the person. Bezdin issues a certain curse and the person has to practice certain laws of Avelus throughout that period. Is the more severe level, it's called Cherem. But Nidui is certain laws of Avelus until he actually gets it lifted.
What's the curse?
What's that?
What kind of curse?
It's along the lines of, I don't remember exactly, but it's along the lines of, if I remember correctly, Mishaporame, it goes, you know, usually say Mishaberach, Mishinav, Mitzchav, Yaakov. This is kind of the opposite. Mishapora, Me'anche Doramabu, Ome'anche Stoim. He who exacted retribution from the people of Mabul, the people of Stoim, and a few other such distinguished parties, he will exact retribution from Pliny ben Pliny. It's not a pleasant thing. Okay.
So what's cherem?
Cherem is taken to the next level. There are more severe set of halachas. Like for example, by regular nidui, you're allowed to talk to the person. By cherem, you can't. A few other such halachas. Okay. forgot who it was that said, I think it's the Chaya Odom, even after the Chaya Odom, so they remember how the concept of every mother striving for her child to be the doctor is a relatively new concept. I remember the day that it used to be that every mother was just striving for her child to become the good Lador. Now, it used to be in Eretz Yisrael that a kid could actually dedicate himself to that. It used to be that way. Lately it became a crime. Now it's already a criminal offense for a child to dedicate himself to learning. But there are still places in the world where it could be done. Halavai, we should see it. Bezos Hashem v'mher b'yameinu. People in Eretz Yisrael should have that opportunity too. Rachmana litzlan. Okay, we move on. That's the primary intent of most of Torah. Yeah. Talk it.
When we talk about the father Shmuel, and the Midrash says he traveled back to be with his wife, he used the shame of Shem.
Yeah.
That I can understand, so to speak, to do the mitzvah, but why, what gave him the right to go back?
You're asking a very good question. You're asking a very good question. But you know what? I want to put it off for after the shiur because I don't want to take our time. It's already on the subject that we discussed. A good question. I'll just tell you the Ben Ish Chai addresses the question, but I'll address the Bli Neder after the shiur. Okay. You know, I'll give the answer in one sentence. The Ben Ish Chai says that he came and went back on the same shame. And that's why he had to go back immediately, because he didn't want to talk in between. He would lose the effect of the shame. He had to come, say the shame, come, do what he needed to do, and go back all without talking in order to use the same shame. He only said it once. It was a round trip. Shame. Okay. We'll begin. The next sugya.
Who was the subject of the shame?
Shmuel's father. Okay. We go all the way back to the Mishnah. Noisei hamito v'chilufeim. Sorry, one more word on the point. The point is not just, like I said before, the point is not just that Talmid HaChacham should be turned into an elite class. The point is, again, the Jewish mentality. Like Rabbi Yehuda says, a person comes to Shamayim, he's a big part of what establishes his status is not who he, what he did, but who he is. Who he is your whole mindset, your whole mentality, your whole value system. And therefore, he says, for example, ish lefi mahalaloi. It's a big, big fundamental point that Rabbi Yehuda says. A person is associated with those who he admires. Meaning, however this works, in Olam Haba, there's the class of Talmidei Chachamim. A person who holds them to be his role models will be classed with them. He'll be classed with them. A person who, you know, knows that he knows he needs to do what he has to do, and he asks Talmidei Chachamim when he has halacha shayla, but the people he admires are somebody else, right? Sports stars. So, I guess the Shemayim, they'll say, alright, that's who you associated yourself with. So, in some way, he'll be associated with them there too. Ish lefi mahalaloi is, it's very important for a person to value what the Torah values. That itself is a very important gauge in determining who a person is for Olam HaEmes purposes. Okay. The Mishnah said, Nois e hamito v'chilufeyim.
Does that mean?
So the Mishnah, we were on the subject of the exemption from mitzvahs for the people involved in the burial procedure. So it said anybody carrying the bed and those who are going to be replacing them, etc., are exempt from Kriyat Shema and from Tefillah. Now, Tanu Rabbanan. So if so, what are we seeing? When there's a funeral, all the people who are key players in the funeral are exempt from Kriyat Shema and Tefillah. Now, the Gemara is going to tell us that that is so, but we take means to try to avoid creating such a situation. And therefore, Tanu Rabbanan, it says in the Braisa, Ein Maitzin Es Hameis Samuch L'Kriyat Shema. We do not begin a funeral close to the time of Kriyat Shema. Meaning, you either begin long enough before the time for Kriyat Shema that the funeral could be ended by then, or once the time for Kriyat Shema arrived, you wait with the funeral until after the Olam has time to daven Shachris. If they did start the funeral by mistake, then you don't stop. Then the halachas of the mission apply that yes, all those involved are exempt. You just continue going straight, even if it's going to mean missing Kriyat Shema and Tefillah. So the Gemara says, "Ini, is that so?" Rav Yosef afku samuch leKriyat Shema. But they did take Rav Yosef out. Rav Yosef's funeral, they took him out close to the Zman Kriyat Shema and went straight through. The people didn't say Kriyat Shema. So the Gemara answers, Adam Choshuv Shani. A distinguished person is different. A person of this level of importance, we disregard anything else, we just go straight with the Levaya, even if it will mean missing Kriyat Shema and Tefillah. Because once again, let's remember, it's not that we're overriding anything. Essentially, those involved in the Levaya are Potter, just that generally we try to avoid the situation. When we're talking about the Levaya of a great person, we don't take that into consideration. What's that? The covet of such a person comes first. They do things straight, no considerations. Only thing is his covet and his levaya. I'll just note that the Paiskim say that this does not apply for anybody today. We don't have anybody who we consider an Adam Choshuv on the level of an Adam Choshuv from the time of the Gemara. And basically the way the Taz puts it down is that any halachas that apply to an Adam Choshuv that are leniencies, meaning any leniency that applies to an Adam Choshuv, we don't consider ourselves as having an Adam Choshuv today. A Chumrah of an Adam Choshuv, the Taz. A Chumrah of an Adam Choshuv, we would apply today. But a Kula of an Adam Choshuv, we say, it could be that they were just talking about what was considered distinguished in the time of the Gemara, which is already an extinct species. Not in this sense, no. Okay. So again, we said that yes, all those carrying the beer, is that how you say it? Buy a beer. Pall bearers. They're all exempt. Now we move into another area of the whole funeral process that was not addressed in the Mishnah. How does it work during the eulogies? So here do we have, is this considered such an essential part of the process that the fact that one is engaged in the eulogies also exempts him from Kriyat Shema and Tefillah? So the Gemara says, Ha'oiskim behespin, when they're engaged in the eulogies, so it depends. The Gemara draws an interesting distinction. Bizman sha'meis muta lefneim, if the eulogies are actually taking place in front of the body, Nishmatin echod echod v'koyrim. So you do not stop the eulogies for davening. Each individual slips out one by one and davens, but we don't stop the eulogies. When the mace is there, when the body is there, it's considered a slight to his covet to stop the proceedings, and therefore we continue straight. And therefore, for example, this is not completely agreed upon by the Poskim, but the Besesiv cites opinions that say that, for example, the one who's actually eulogizing would not stop. He would go straight, even if he misses Kriyat Shema. But the Tzibur should not disperse, but one person at a time slips out and says Kriyat Shema. Eina meis muta lifneim. Oh, yeah, that's part of not just more important than davening communion, more than davening altogether. It's considered that a person is engaged in a mitzvah, and even if it'll mean missing Kriyat Shema and Tefillah altogether, we do that. Oh, 1 minute. You're saying with regard to the fact that each individual slips out. Oh, right. Yes, that's right. For the individuals, we say that yes, it's better that they should daven by themselves rather than form a minyan at the expense of the proceedings. But for the actual person, the eulogizer himself, we might even say that the in order to enable the eulogy to go on, it would even come at the expense of, even if he would completely miss Kriyat Shema and Tefillah, because once again, this is Oisik Mitzvah. Now, Eina Meis Muta Lifneim, if the dead is not actually there, let's say they're holding the eulogies somewhere else, This sometimes happens. Sometimes you might have it in a shul while the mace is in a different room or outside or something like that. So in such a case, the continuity of the eulogy is not necessarily considered such an essential aspect of kavod hames, and therefore heng yoshev v'karen, they do stop, they say kriya shema v'hu yoshev v'daimin, and the mourner himself, we remember he's not allowed to be saying kriya shema or anything like that, he sits quietly.
Heng, if the mace is in the same building?
No, if the mace is not there. Oh, if it's in the same building in a different room?
For example, we used to, we didn't bring the mace into the actual,
right, we don't bring him into a shul.
It was in the lobby.
Right, no, so as long as it's not in the same room, that's called not in front of them. Not in the same room is called not in front of them. And that's talk of the minute. We don't bring a mace into the shul unless it's like the Rav or something like that. So as long as it's not in the same room, it's called not in front of them. So yes, then they would take a break for Kriya Shema and Tefillah. When they say Kriya Shema, he just sits quietly. Heim oimdu umispalulim, and then when they stand and davin, hu oimed umatzdik olav esadin. He stands and says his own little thing, not tefillah, but he says what we call tziduk hadin. He acknowledges. He says a formula acknowledging the justness of Hashem's judgment. So what does he say? So he says as follows. Oimer, he says, so this is the initial nusach, which we don't actually say. Let's see. Ribon ha'olamim, Master of the World, harbei chatasi lefanecha, I have sinned exceedingly in front of you, v'lo nifrato mimeni echad mili elef, and you have not punished me for one of a thousand. Yiratzai milfanecha, so you conclude by saying, may it please you, Hashem, elekeinu, shetigdor pirtzeisenu, that you fence in our breaches, upirtzeis kolamcho v'yisrael berachamim, and the breaches of all of your nation Israel, berachamim, with mercy. So the truth is that this is something of a scary statement. My person is saying, you know how deserving I really am? Yes, you hit me now. I lost a loved one, but it's not one in a thousand to what I'm deserving of. So Amar Abaye, Abaye said, no, don't say that. Lo mi boyle le inish le mema hochi. A person should not say such a thing. Do Amar Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish, because Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish said, v'chein tana b'shmei Rabbi Yosi. We also have a brisa saying the same thing in the name of Rabbi Yosi. Le oilom al yiftach odom piv lesotan is a famous principle. Do not open your mouth to the satan. Meaning, don't you provide the satan with an opening to hit you. V'omar av Yosef, meaning in other words, you have to be aware that your speech creates realities. As we'll see now, look at this example. Omar Rav Yosef. Rav Yosef said, my Korah. What's the scriptural source for this? Shenema says in the Pasuk, Kim'at kisdoim hayinu. The Jewish people said, we were almost like Sdoim. Ma'ahadulu Navi, well, that was a dangerous thing to say. Don't compare yourself to Sdoim. What did the Navi respond? Shimud va Hashem k'tzinei Sdoim. Hear the word of Hashem, officers of Sdoim. Meaning once they said, oh, we're kind of like Sdoim, boom, that reality was locked in. So therefore a person has to be very careful of what you say. We have to realize that speech is not just in the air. Speech actually creates realities. So therefore never say something dangerous, something that could, that if it were realized would be dangerous to you.
What was the Navi trying to do? To offset something? He was trying to...
No, it's kind of like on the contrary. You see that once they said, oh, we're almost like Stein.
The people.
Once the people said that, it kind of turned into, oh, now Hashem is viewing you as the people of Stein. Because a person's speech has a very, very great effect. That's why it's to the extent that, well, we know that that's it. Issur d'oraisa, the curse, right? Issur d'oraisa, the curse of another Jew. Why? Chinuch says, because l'maisa, we don't know what our speech can do. Speech creates effects. You don't know how it all manifests.
Is it directed only with the Shem Hashem?
What's that?
Is that only with the Shem Hashem?
You're right. It's an issue with the Shem Hashem, but the idea is, and therefore l'maisa, the concept applies to any form of cursing. Speech creates realities. The truth is that the higher of a level a person is on, the greater the effect of that will be. But at the same time, no Jew should undermine the power of his own speech.
And two-way speech is also the other way?
Meaning? Oh yes, positive speech? Yes.
All millionaires of Israel.
Yes, yes, absolutely. The Gemara says both. Yeah, the Gemara says both. Never take a simpleton's curse lightly, and never take a simpleton's blessing lightly. The words of a Jew have a great effect. To the extent, even things that might even seem strange, like the Gemara, that's why, for example, the Gemara Mesachim says, don't be a bearer of bad news. Something unfortunate happens. It's so exciting to be the one breaking the news. But we find the Chazal take great pains not to actually articulate bad tidings. Like, for example, when there was somebody, one of the great Chachamim had died, the Chachamim were davening them in the Beis Medrash, and they sent one of the Talmid to go check what the story with him was. So when he came back, he didn't say anything. He tore his shirt. He didn't want to shock everybody. So he tore his garment, turned it around to the back, came in. They asked him what's going on, and he kept quiet, and then they noticed the tear in the back, because he didn't want to say it. I would hear it. See, even to such an extent where it already happened, yet there's all kinds of different levels of spirituality, and whatever this means, this is basically what you see in the Mefarshim there. Saying it locks in the reality even stronger, meaning yes, he's dead, but somehow saying it makes that unfortunate reality even stronger and can cause even bigger problems. So you have to be very careful about the things we say. Okay. What's that? That's the concept of Ayin Hara, how it's so even in thought. Ayin Hara is the same idea. You thinking negative thoughts about a person can actually release spiritual energies that can have that effect. And the same goes for the positive. Thinking positive thoughts about a person can actually benefit him. So you have to be... That's why also, for example, right? You know, believe Yitzchok Bar Ditchever's big career was saying anything positive he could about the Jews, giving a positive twist on anything. What was the idea? The idea was that then it's really viewed that way in Hashemayim. Jews have a great kliach of establishing the way things work. If a person expresses himself negatively about Jews, you don't know what kind of problems he might be causing. Always look, it gives Hashem nachas to hear you speaking positively about his children. Whatever good things you can say about a Jew, is worth doing so.
Don't be the bearer of bad news. Like,
you try to avoid it. If you can say it without articulating it, it's better to do that. There's even a case with Reb Shlomo Zalman Erbach. Everybody's familiar with the concept of Ayin Hara, which is also a scary thing when you see the Maharal and the Chazon Ish. The way it works is Mamish, they say, they call it a natural force, which hasn't been identified yet, might be on a certain spiritual level, that yes, a person's thoughts create energies that actually can have that effect. Maybe not exactly the way he thought it, maybe in a smaller way, but yes, a person's thoughts actually create energies. So, Shlomo Zalman Auerbach one time, a Talmud of his, you see this in the other direction also, a Talmud of his was consulting with him about buying an apartment, not to buy an apartment. And he basically guided him through all the steps of actually purchasing the apartment and where he should buy it, etc. When he finally bought the apartment, Shlomo Zalman Auerbach said, told him he wants to come see the apartment. Surprising thing, Shlomo Zalman Auerbach had time to go touring people's apartments. But that was what he wanted. He wanted to come see, he was a close Talmud. And he took a tour of the apartment. He wanted the Talmud to show him all the different rooms and what he's going to be doing in the different rooms. So afterwards the Talmud said, why did the Rebbe want to see my apartment? So Shlomo Zalman said, I was very happy for you. I wanted to go into your apartment and look with an ayin toiva, see your kitchen and think, ah, I'm happy you're going to be enjoying that kitchen. See that room and think, ah, I'm happy you're going to be enjoying that room. And that will actually affect an ayin toiva. It'll bring blessing into the home. It's a very real thing. Okay. We move on. So, therefore... What's that?
But most people don't have that ayin toiva. So you're saying that you're exposing yourself to danger when you are letting people into your home?
Yes, the truth is that it's a very, very strong point that a person should make should try as much as he can not to flaunt his blessings, because you're exposing yourself to ayin hara. Since most people I don't know if most people, many people will look at it with a certain envy. It's a dangerous thing to expose yourself to Ayin Hara, to the extent that the Chachamim said that the majority of people die as a result of Ayin Hara. It's a scary thing. And therefore, yes, Rav Dessler says that, yeah, a person should make a point of either taking out a certain insurance on your things or keeping them concealed. How do you take out Ayin Hara insurance? The Gemara would say, once you do a mitzvah with a certain asset, it has a certain insurance, a certain bracha there that protects it to an extent against Ayin Hara. So anything you get, so for example, a person gets a big inheritance, first thing you should do is buy some Sefer Kodesh with it. Right? Win the lottery. Buy a Sefer Kodesh, buy a new shas. Or give tzedakah with it. Or Rav Dessler says that by being generous with your assets, you will, it's also a means of countering Ayin Hara. But yes, it's important for a person, the less people are exposed to what's going on with you, to your good fortune, the better off you are.
Okay.
Basically, yeah. Envy will have the effect of an Ayin Hara. Yeah. Okay. We move on. So therefore, yeah, Lamaisa, in Halacha we adjust this Nusach, which basically just says, we don't say, oh, I sinned against you so much. The Nusach is more adjusted to say something like, everything you do is just, and may it be your will to fence in all of our breaches. Okay, so bottom line, what did we see here? Is eulogy considered such a mitzvah that it actually exempts people from Kriyat Shema, etc.? So he said that it depends. If it's in front of the dead person, yes, we do not interrupt the eulogies for the sake of Kriyat Shema and Tefillah, but individuals should slip out one by one. If it's not in front of the dead person, then yes, we'll actually stop the eulogies and hold the minyan. Next, Kavur is Hameis V'Chazur. Further on the subject of the exemptions. So once they buried the dead person, what's the next step after burying the dead person? They gather, they form the shura. The shura, the aisle that the avel walks through, and as he passes by, each person expresses his condolences. So this also is, well, either part of the mitzvah of burying the dead, or a new mitzvah that kicks in immediately after the dead is buried. But whatever it is, participating this shura is also a mitzvah that creates a situation of oisik b'mitzvah and exempts you of kriyat shema. And therefore, im yicholim lahaschil, the Mishnah said, if you can manage to recite kriyat shema before you reach the shura, coming back from the cemetery to the shura, if you can manage to recite Kriyat Shema before you reach the Shura, do so. But if not, don't. Skip it. Now you're in the middle of a new mitzvah. Now you are consoling the mourner. So now, the Gemara says, the Mishnah implies, im yecholim lahaschil veligmor eskula in. The implication is, if you can begin Kriyat Shema and complete it, if you can say the whole thing, say it. But if, let's say there's only 1 minute, and you only manage to say, let's say, the first pasuk, or just ve'ahavta, the implication is that not. Mishnah seemed to say, if you can begin and finish. So, Raminu, we pose a contradiction to that. Kavu es hameis, Brisa says, if they buried the dead, the chazur, they're on their way back. Im yicholim lahaschil v'ligmar, if they can manage to begin and complete, afilu perek echad, oy pasuk echad, even if you'll just manage one chapter, or even if just one pasuk, do that. Now, the truth is, this is very logical, because we've already seen that according to certain opinions, the first pasuk is all that's d'oraisa, or maybe the first perek. But whatever it is, at the very least, it's separate mitzvahs, right? So the Gemara says, you're right. Hachinami ka'amar. You're right. The Mishnah didn't mean if you can say all three parshas. What the Mishnah meant was, im yicholim v'lahaschil v'ligmar afilu perek echad, afilu pasuk echad, if you can begin and complete even just one perek, or even just one pasuk, ad shelo yagiu l'shura, before reaching the shura, yaschilu. Begin.
What does that mean, the shura?
What's that?
What does that mean, the shura?
The shura was right after the burial. They would gather outside the graveyard and form two rows through which the mourner would pass through, and as he's passing through, everybody extends their condolences. So you immediately begin the mitzvah of comforting the mourner. So that also overrides Kriya Shema.
You don't have to leave the graveyard.
What's that? Right.
You don't have to leave the graveyard.
They're
just lining up right,
right there. Right. The truth is that if that's how they're doing it, then this halacha wouldn't apply, because you're not allowed to say Kriya Shema in the graveyard.
That's right.
This halacha will only apply if they're doing it outside. In earlier times, they generally had like a clearing outside of the grave area where they did these things. Right. So v'im lav, if they can't manage to even say just that first pasuk, then lo yaschilu, don't start. Oh, so the truth is what you're asking, you're getting into a big discussion of the poskim. What's that? You're going to comment.
It's not part of the Torah.
So you're asking a good question. So Rav Shlomo is asking, if it's not part of the Kvura, if it's a new mitzvah, why should that override Kriya Shema? You finished the Kvura, now you have a chiyuv to recite Kriya Shema. We know that once you have a chiyuv to do one mitzvah, you can't get involved in a different mitzvah and say I'm exempt, right? That's the rule with Oseg B'mitzvah. The Zman came, you have to do the mitzvah. So it's a good question. So the Rishonim give two answers to this. One answer, this is the Meiri says no, it's all considered one continuous process. The mitzvah of burying the dead evolves into the mitzvah of comforting the mourner. It's one continuous mitzvah, and therefore it's considered that you've still been involved in that mitzvah all the way through. The mitzvah of Kriya Shema never kicked in. The Ritva says, practically it plays out in the same way, but it's a little different. The Ritva says, no, it's two separate mitzvahs. Burying the dead is burying the dead. That's Takawi Paske. Burying the dead is burying the dead. Comforting the mourner is comforting the mourner. One is chesed to A, the other is chesed to B. It's two different parties. But yet the Ritva says, the chiyuv to comfort the mourner kicks in the instant the dead is buried. So you're right, it's not one continuous mitzvah, it's a different mitzvah. But it's not that the mitzvah begins once you get to the shura. Right. It goes straight from burying into comforting, and therefore Kriya Shema doesn't have a chance to kick in.
So in the Ritva's case, though, we say also mitzvah question in mitzvah, you're saying this mitzvah came first, but we also say that one mitzvah has this man where it's gonna end, that would override a mitzvah that has 7 days to do it. So I can
come
to the mourner for 7 days.
No, not if you're already involved.
Left to say.
No, if you're already involved in the mitzvah, we don't say that. Once you're involved in the mitzvah before, even if it's a mitzvah she'evel zmano, Talmud Torah is the exception to the rule. Talmud Torah is the one mitzvah that you stop for any mitzvah. We don't say Usik by mitzvah by Talmud Torah, because otherwise you'll never do anything else. Right? But with other mitzvahs we do say, even if it's a mitzvah she'evel zmano, if you're already involved in something else before the time came, right? Once the time comes for Kriya Shema, you can't say, I have a great idea. Instead of going to Minyan, I'm going to go to, get involved with some chesed. No, you can't do that. But if you were talking involved with the mitzvah before the Zman for Kriya Shema hit, you continue straight to the Zman of Kriya Shema. That's taka how it would work.
Just the fact that you have, now you just asked it for the dead person, and then your parents are coming in. Does that in any way impact on your saying Shema?
Well, the main thing with saying Shema is just that you should be clean. Tameh doesn't matter. As long as your hands are not filthy, Shema is okay. Okay? Fine, we'll stop here. Yeah, right. Yeah, you can.
Practically speaking, you always have time to say Shema.